This week on Potlatch, Sadie Neacuk of Barrow talks about justice and subsistence. Here's Tom Rush with Starting Off and the Galveston Flood.
Go. I wouldn't have a mighty storm. people all the way.
Tom Rush. During her long and stormy career as a magistrate, Sadie Neacook, in the Barrow area, had to balance the rights of natives to hunt and fish for a living with the rights and the obligations of the state, national, and even international law. On this first portion of the program, she recalls an attempt by the United States government to enforce the Migratory Bird Treaty. This treaty banned hunting of waterfowl during the times of the year when they flew over the northern regions. But first, Sadie Neacook remembers Alaskan hunting regulations before statehood.
The old laws stated that a native of Alaska would not be restricted from taking any animal if he's hungry. There is no crime committed that at that portion of it. But when Alaska became a state, the state evaluated each area, I believe, each district for maintenance of rules. And we ran into the natives. When I say we, I mean the Eskimos and the natives of what's known as the native of Alaska. The subsistence type hunting wasn't fully touched when Alaska first became a state, but then they started putting seasons on waterfowl, moose, caribou, and all seal. The hunting seasons, trapping, for instance, has always been from the 1st of December to April here in the northern area. You can't trap other than that area. And whereas we used the fur for, if we caught out of season, we couldn't sell the hide. It had to be used for your own personal garment. And that didn't have any bearing on any breaking of law. But today, in 1962-63, the state got interested in enforcing the waterfowl. You may have heard little about it. For this northern area, even though the state said they would not take part in changing some of the laws among the native people, they did take a big step in trying to enforce the waterfowl, like the eider, the geese, and the mallard, known as the waterfowl, you know. Well, for this area, we had no open season where these waterfowl came. They came in this area from May until September, and then we didn't have any more. When the whaling season is poor, waterfowl is the only fresh meat available up here. And at the time it was being enforced by the state that no taking of waterfowl should be in effect for this northern area, we were caught between, you know, a feeling. How else are we going to get it? We don't have any open season. There was a treaty between Mexico, United States, and Canada that the seasons be open from September till May for the waterfowl. But up here in part of Canada, we get it out of season. And that was a big change, and we didn't know how to cope with it. They sent State Game Commission personnel up here to enforce it. But the thing that really solved our problem was for every man, woman, and child at the time to commit himself for the taking of waterfowl whenever arrest was made. And it came out in the news, everything. We had talked about it. The people depended pretty much on me to decide what step to take. And, you know, up till the time the waterfowl situation was finally neutralized, I always felt guilty because I took an oath that I would not take part in the uprising or whatever when I took the position of magistrate. But you're there also to help. When you're a magistrate, any problem area that might be solved, you don't do it behind your people, your the people that you work with. You don't betray the people. I have never, at least, tried to betray or fool some of my people with whatever I could help them with. I get so involved in the solution. Getting to the core of the problem was my main concern, because so many of our people were charged with violating this, violating that, where they have had no education whatsoever in that part of the law. They had never been placed on restriction with hunting for their subsistence, and here all of a sudden we're there, people are getting arrested for violating this, and then moose hardly ever wanders up this far. You know, one summer we had 6 or 7 moose accidentally wander in this area, and the people not knowing what to do about their situation when they learned there was a season for moose, they self-committed themselves to the Game Commission. And what am I going to do? I got this. I had to kill it because I injured it. And without any warning, some of the Game Commission, very unfair, I thought in my mind when the case was brought about. Without, you know, they wrote the letters themselves, the rule violators. They wrote the letters to the Game Commission and self-committed themselves. What do I do about this? What's the law on it? And I remember 2 cases where they were brought to my attention. The game warden came up here and arrested, without warning, 2 of our people and brought them before me. And they were the 2 men that had families of, say, 10 to 16 in the home. They needed the meat. But the solution for such violations is where the judge will, you know, use common sense to decide it, actually, if you're one of the natives. And they depend on you to solve the problem. There, instead of putting on a heavy fine or putting the man in jail, sentencing him to serve time, I know I wouldn't have gained much if I sent somebody to jail on conviction, because I knew he was needed in his family to support. If I had taken the man out and given a severe sentence of saying, give him the limit, a $500 fine or so, or $1,000 fine, he didn't have the money. And it would pressure him to go and try and find whatever to pay that amount.
And here he's already, you know, he's not aware he broke the law. This was our main downfall, because the people were used to the law to govern their hunting and so on and so forth. So with these few violations, the solution, if I ask some of my superiors, how do I go about it, what do I do? The only advice they would give me is just use common sense to solve it. These are your people, you know the situation. And you know, sometimes it's hard when you're trusted to make the decision for your people, and at the same time it makes you wonder whether you're doing the right thing by fining or putting the person in jail, you know. That type. But when everybody was guilty of that waterfall thing, I remember Eben, everybody backed me in this whole community. They were there, I didn't do it behind their back. They came and asked advice of me how to solve it. Well, how else are we going to solve it? We're all guilty of taking the waterfall that spring, every man, woman, and child. Because hunting, whaling was before that time. And so I said, well, I'll back you by notifying the governor's office of our problem. The only way we can do it is to self-commit himself. Every man, woman, and child in this community did to self-commit himself, and they did, you know, they did just that. And the game warden was furious about it. He didn't know we were doing this behind his back. But that was the only way we could solve it. And it went to the legislature. There were some 148 to 50 commitments, where it meant that a man and wife, maybe a son, probably could go to jail for violating that new game law. And so the legislature met and made it neutral for us to be able to hunt the waterfowl out of season. Though the game wardens would come up here and say, do you have a duck step? I said, what good is it? Well, the answer would be, well, it would help our department if you would sell these duck stamps, but I've never encouraged it to the point where it seemed it's a dollar stamp, you know. But for out of season, why should we buy a duck stamp to hunt? Though many did, you know, just to comply with whatever the game commission had. And then that was one way we solved that one area.
I'll tell you of a man, he was a half-breed too. He knew the woods and roamed them, he was an outcast true. The people, they all run him off, he never came around. And when it came to hiding, he sure could not be found. They called him Johnny Halfbreed, and they made it mighty clear. They called him Johnny Halfbreed, half-breeds ain't welcome here. Mongrels ain't invited, and no curs do we allow. So listen, Johnny Halfbreed, get out and get out now. The city that we speak of was named for Galilee, within a forest ocean, a mighty sea of trees. All around it in the forest, Halfbreed Johnny rambled round. He knew all about the eagle and where honey could be found. Not a white man nor an Indian, no parents and no land. Trees, they were his teachers, and the animals his clan. He could converse with the otter, and he held forth with the bear. They say he talked to fishes and to birds when they were there. They called him Johnny Halfbreed, and they made it mighty clear. They called him Johnny Halfbreed, half-breeds ain't welcome here. Mongrels ain't invited, and no curs do we allow. So listen, Johnny Halfbreed, get out and get out now. Now in the town we speak of, the new mayor had a child, a girl of 6 or 7, and not uncommon wild. Often she would wander and then return to home, till once a flying squirrel tempted her to roam. She followed half a mile or more until she lost the track. Panic hit her suddenly, she knew of no way back. The forest turned and twisted all about her every way, and all her steps were wrong ones when she got lost that day. They called him Johnny Halfbreed, and they made it mighty clear. They called him Johnny Halfbreed, halfbreeds ain't welcome here. Mongrels ain't invited, and no curs do we allow. So listen, Johnny Halfbreed, get out and get out now. When she turned up missing, a mighty search was called. They feared that she was murdered and worried she was mauled. They tramped the woods for miles around and helicopters flew. And when all that was finished, nothing's all they knew. Someone mentioned Johnny and someone was laughed down. Someone spoke of woodcraft and some said that forest clown. Some said, why, he is just a bum, a dirty lost half-breed. But Johnny was their one hope, and they sent for him with speed. They called him Johnny Half-Breed, and they made it mighty clear. They called him Johnny Half-Breed, half-breeds ain't welcome here. Mongrels ain't invited, and no curs do we allow. So listen, Johnny Half-Breed, get out and get out now. Johnny started searching until he tracked the child, carried her in his half-breed arms out of the forest wild. He was hero for a day, they asked him to remain. They said they'd learned their lesson, that all people are the same. Johnny said, you take your handshakes, your sidewalks and your town. Ask for me by the whippoorwill, he'll say where I'll be found. I prefer to talk with wildcats and to hear the wild goose moan. I'm headed back to wilderness. The forest is my home.
Peter Lafarge. Next, Sadie Neacook recalls a more recent subsistence hunting problem.
Caribou are plentiful up here in this area, Barrow. But because of so many reports of the herds diminishing last year, the Game Commission, the conservationists and so forth, people who work with that type of law where they find after survey counts and so on and so forth, they felt that the natives should not take caribou anymore. And so they ruled by September they would have something written out in order for us. August 15, 76 was the last day for our taking of caribou without any restrictions. But after that, then no more. So I started talking to the people up north that they should comply with that until some rules were made that we might be able to work and not hurt ourselves. And then when the rule was made, the governor's office promised, someone from the governor's office came up here and promised that food stamps would be given to the native to supplement his diet of meat, which was so expensive, if it meant beef or chicken or turkey, the items that we're not used to. They claimed that our hunting with whale and waterfowl was sufficient. You know, we could live on the seal, the whale, and the fish, whatever fish we might be able to get. Now we may not be able to hunt the whale like we used to anymore. That's still a big question mark again today. You know, they're resolving to save the mammal. They gave us a count last year on it to the whalers, saying that there's about 275 species left of bowhead. But when we observed the big mammal in the water we know it's more than that, because the schools of whales that come up through here, we call them whales. We don't call them by a specific species, you know. We think that the bowhead is the only one that has bay leaves, like we see it. That's the only kind of whale that comes up here. There are a few gray ones, the kind with all the barnacles on the outside, but we don't hunt those. Though the meat is very delicious when we get one, when the crews get one. The muskuk and the delicacies of a bowhead are not there in any other species. There are a few belugas, the white whale, that come through here, but not to the extent where we can store enough of it. The bowhead is the only main of source of subsistence in the whaling season, which is actually a month and a half up here, from April 15th to the last part of May. Sometimes it isn't even that long. The ice conditions govern our whaling season up here, how long we can have it. But then when the spring whaling is off, then we can have another chance of whaling in the fall when the whales start migrating south. But that's also quite a dangerous deal, because the men have to go out in boats some length, and then sometimes we're not able to save the meat because it gets bloated the way we, our primitive ways of trying to bring it in. If a crew catches a whale in the fall, if it's 30 miles out, it takes from 12 to 14 hours to bring the darn thing in, tow it in, even with several boats trying to tow it in. Sometimes if the weather changes to the point where they're not able to tow it in, then they have to cut the line in order to save themselves. The hazards in the sea, the changing of wind.
We'll hear more from Sadie Neacook next week, but now, Chet Atkins. White Silver Sands with Chet Atkins, concluding Potlatch for this week. I'm Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening.
Potlatch came to you from KUAC in Fairbanks. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting gave some of the money to produce this program.
From the University of Alaska, this has been a KUAC production.